Let's find out what it says in today's papers now. Here's John S. Doyle.
The papers have not finished with the John McNulty affair, but this morning another instance of government favouritism makes the front page of the Irish Times. Fiach Kelly reports that the Minister of State at the Department of the Environment has hired a Director of Irish Water, the semi-state body which his department oversees, as his personal driver. The paper says that Hilary Quinlan, then a Fine Gael councillor, was appointed to the Board of Irish Water last November, for which he is paid an annual fee of €15,000. Mr Quinlan lost his Waterford City seat in the local elections last May and has since been hired as a ministerial driver by Paddy Coffey, the junior minister, for which he is paid a further €665 a week. He also got a €57,000 gratuity for losing his council seat. Questioned about the matter, Mr Quinlan said, "You tell me one party out there who doesn't look after their own." And he asked the Times why there wasn't more of a focus on the economy. "We were all nearly eating out of bins 3 years ago," he said. As for John McNulty, the Times columnist Fintan O'Toole recalls the seven key principles that must be followed by holders of public office, as set down in the UK by a committee set up after the outbreak of sleaze under John Major's government in the 1990s. In the case of Mr McNulty, briefly a board member of the Irish Museum of Modern Art, but still a candidate for the Shannon, six of these principles were seriously compromised by Enda Kenny and the Arts Minister Heather Humphreys, writes O'Toole. And they are selflessness, objectivity, accountability, openness, honesty and leadership. The Irish Sun comments in an editorial, "Enda Kenny can expect a grilling in the Doyle this morning, and he has no one to blame but himself." The Irish Independent's lead story concerns the tax affairs of the technology firm Apple. Thomas Molloy writes that the state could collect an unwanted tax windfall worth billions of euro if Apple is forced to pay up following a probe into its affairs by Brussels. The Times leads with another Brussels story. Suzanne Lynch reports that the European Commission is putting renewed pressure on the government to implement cuts of €2 billion in the coming budget, echoing the views of both the IMF and Ireland's Fiscal Advisory Council. The Irish Daily Star and The Sun both lead with a story written by David Raley. It concerns the mother of the little girl who died in a farm accident in County Cork on Sunday. The papers say that Linda Dinsberger and her husband Rivo have to wait for a post-mortem before they can see their daughter Paula. The main story for the Irish Daily Mirror concerns the questioning by Gardaí of a man suspected of the stabbing of Dublin footballer Johnny Cooper. The Irish Examiner's lead story tells us that outsized mortgages are back and that four reports published today point to growing pressure in the property market. In echoes of the recklessness that preceded the crash, says the paper, some banks are lending up to 4.5 times combined income, when a maximum of 3 to 4 times is considered prudent. And the Irish Daily Mail leads with what the paper describes as a chronic shortage of priests. This, says Eamon Donoghue, could result in funerals with up to 10 coffins in one church at the same time. And according to the Association of Catholic Priests, it could mean that weddings might have to be conducted by a layperson with no mass.
John, thank you. It's 11 minutes past 7. Conor Brophy's here with the Business News. Morning, Conor.
Morning, Gavin, and a little bit more detail on home multiples and home prices at the moment, because home buyers should be limited to borrowing a maximum of 4 times their combined income for a couple. They should also be restricted to a mortgage representing no more than 80% of the purchase price of a home, according to a new report on the property market from Davy. The report urges the central bank to take action to ensure borrowers are not overextending themselves. Davy concludes that although house prices are still 40% below the peak of the market, they're far from cheap. At their peak, it says, house prices in Ireland were valued at over 9 times the national average income. The current level is about 5 times average income. That still looks relatively expensive compared to, for example, the UK, where the ratio of price to income is slightly less than 5 times. The report also raises concerns about sustainability of mortgage debt for some borrowers as interest rates rise from their current low levels over the 25 to 35 year time horizon of a home loan. Tourism is back, says Fáilte Ireland, responding to the results of its latest index of sentiment in the sector. That's based on interviews with a sample of 745 representatives from across the industry. Three quarters of them say business is up on last year's levels and that they are confident growth will continue in the year ahead. That's the highest level of positive sentiment recorded in the sector by Fáilte Ireland in 8 years. In 2008, by contrast, just 14%, fewer than one in seven respondents, reported themselves to be upbeat about prospects. And we'll be hearing from Fáilte Ireland Chief Executive Sean Quinn at 10 to 8. The US is set to overtake Saudi Arabia as the world's leading producer of petroleum products for the first time since 1991. American production levels have drawn level with output from the kingdom, that's Saudi Arabia, not Kerry, at 11.5 million barrels a day, according to the International Energy Agency. Advances in exploration technology have made viable US oil fields, which previously would not have been commercially developed. Since 2012, US oil output has increased by 3.5 million barrels a day and is now on track to outstrip that of Saudi Arabia within the next 2 months. On a related note, half-year results just in for the Irish exploration company Providence Resources show a €3.4 million net loss compared to a €1.3 million loss for the same period last year. And finally, for now, in currency news, the euro is trading at $1 26.9 cents and 78.1 pence sterling.
Thanks, Conor. 13 minutes past seven. Today is the last day of free water. From tomorrow, all homes with or without a meter will be charged. You'll get bills from Irish Water every 3 months starting in January. This morning, the Commission for Energy Regulation has announced the charges. Paul McGowan from the CER will be here later to talk about the changes they've made from the proposed pricing structure, which was unveiled in a consultation document earlier this year. Our reporter, Justin McCarthy, has seen the charges and he's here now. Justin, how much are people going to pay for water?
Yeah, well, as you said there, Gavin, the Commission published a consultation paper at the end of July and that set out the proposed charges. And since then, it received 345 responses and queries. And having considered the comments, it has made a number of changes to its pricing structure. And I'll go through those changes in a minute. But first, just to give you an idea of the basic charges that people will pay. There'll be two types of customer, those with meters and those without meters. And if you have a meter, you'll pay for the water you use at a rate of €2.44 per 1,000 litres, and you'll pay the same again for wastewater services. So in other words, for every 1,000 litres you use, you'll pay just short of €5 or €4.88. Children will be given a free allowance of 21,000 litres. Now, if you don't have a meter, for example, if you're living in an apartment block or your home simply hasn't been metered yet, then you'll pay an assessed charge, and that will be €176 for a home with one adult or €278 for a home with two adults and two children, for example. That's what most families will pay, around €278, which of course is about 20% higher than the €240 which the government said it would charge the average household.
Now, you mentioned there that the regulator has made some changes to the water charges plan announced in July. What are they?
Yeah, there are a few significant changes made to the plan announced earlier this year. First of all, customers are to have their total charges capped at the unmetered assessed charge for a period of 9 months. In other words, for a period of 9 months, whether you're metered or not metered, you're going to know exactly how much you're going to pay.
So there'll be a maximum amount you'll pay whether you're on a meter or not on a meter. Everybody will be the same for the first few months.
For the first 9 months. In the consultation period, that was a six-month period suggested, but they've upped it to 9 months. And the measure is being introduced to kind of help people ease the transition into metered charging. The second big change is that customers who live in areas where the water is not drinkable, and we've heard a lot about that in areas like Roscommon, those customers will not pay any water supply charge once a boil water notice has been in place for 24 hours. In the public consultation, it was proposed that they would still pay 50% of their water supply charges, but now they're not going to pay any supply charge. But it's important to say that they will still pay their wastewater charge. So in other words, their bill would be roughly half what it would have been. The third major change then affects customers who move from an assessed charge to a metered charge. If they can show that their metered consumption is less than their assessed consumption used during the assessed charge period, then they'll be given a rebate after a period of 6 months. And in the consultation, a 12-month period was suggested there.
People with second homes, how much are they going to pay?
Well, if you have a second home or a holiday home and it's not being used during the year, you'll pay a charge of €125 per annum in the consultation. A charge of €160 was suggested. But if you are a landlord and you're renting out your home to tenants, the tenants will have to pay the water bill.
Is there anybody else who's entitled to a cap or an exemption?
Well, the Commission says that if Irish Water identifies a water leak at a customer's premises having installed a meter, the customer will then have their charges capped at the assessed charge until the leak is fixed. And the regulator has also said that customers with medical conditions which require increased water consumption, that those will be also capped at the assessed charge rate if they have a meter installed.
So can you give us a few examples of how much people will pay on a day-to-day basis? This is, of course, presuming they have a meter.
Yeah, just a few basic examples, I suppose. It takes around 10 litres to flush the toilet, so that'll cost around 5 cent to go, so 5 cent to spend a penny. A bath uses around 80 litres of water, which would cost you around 38 cent. A 5-minute shower would use around 45 litres of water, so that'll cost you around 20 cents. So if you've got two people in a house taking a 5-minute shower every day, the charges will amount to around €150 per year. And I suppose if you're lucky enough, or maybe unlucky enough, to have a 25-metre swimming pool in your garden, then you'll pay between €800 and €900 to fill that up.
Who's going to be hit the hardest here?
I suppose if you're in a house where you've got two or three college-going children over the age of 18, then you're going to be hit the hardest. For example, a household where you've got two adults and two college-going students, you'll pay an assessed charge of €483. Or if you've five adults in your house, you'll pay a rate of €586. So
okay,
that's pretty hefty.
Now, the charges have been set. Could they be increased?
Well, the charges have been set for the next 2 years, and they won't be increased or decreased until 2 years' time. But after that, the Commission for Energy Regulation will examine the charges again, and it will look at the substantial amount of data that it has gathered in the meantime before deciding what to do next. And it's possible that, yes, the charges could be varied up or down after that.
And they're set now until the 31st of December 2016. Justin McCarthy, thank you.
Britain's Chancellor is moving on the so-called double Irish, the move announced at the Tory conference yesterday and followed a front-page story in the Financial Times yesterday, which suggested that Europe was about to hit Ireland and Apple for so-called backroom tax deals. The government here has denied it has breached state aid rules. The European Commission will, it's expected today, publish a document stating what it's looking into and why, but it won't yet reach the kind of conclusions we've been reading about, or so we're now being told. Tim Warstall is a senior fellow at the Adam Smith Institute, an independent UK-based think tank, and is on the line. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
You've been blogging for Forbes on this. What's the reality as you know it?
Well, back in June, the European Commission said they wanted to look at the situation of Apple's taxation in Ireland. And the document we expect today is their formal laying out of what they want to look into. Unlike, as you say, the Financial Times yesterday saying that Apple is about to be fined over their tax arrangements, this is much more part of the continental legal system where they say, this is what we're going to look into, the next step is here are the details of what we're going to look into, and then the investigation carries on into the future.
And going on previous such investigations, that could be a very lengthy process.
Oh, it could be, absolutely. The Commission investigated Microsoft for 16 years, and it's currently been investigating Google for 4. So nobody thinks the Apple investigation will take that long, but just to give you an idea of quite how long these things can take.
Of course, there's nothing to say that this inquiry or investigation or probe, call it what you will, won't reach the kind of conclusions we read about yesterday.
This is entirely true. What they're specifically looking into is a detail of tax law called transfer pricing. Effectively, everybody knows that Apple is drawing profit into Ireland as a result of Ireland having that wonderfully low tax rate. But that's not actually either illegal or a problem. It's allowed for in all of the international tax treaties. The problem would be if Apple was charging its own subsidiaries like Apple UK or Apple Germany a different price from what it was charging something like Vodafone UK or Vodafone Germany. That would be a breach of the transfer pricing rules because it would be sucking Apple UK's righteous profit into Ireland. And that's specifically what is being looked at. What are the prices that Apple has been charging both its own other subsidiaries and true third-party unrelated companies for the same equipment? Now, if they have been found in breach of that, then that could be regarded as illegal state aid, and therefore the Irish Treasury or the Irish government would need to recover that from Apple itself.
Yes, we were speculating yesterday about the possible results. Much talk about a fine for Apple. Is that a possibility?
No, there are never fines in the case of illegal state aid. The illegal state aid must be recovered, but there is not any further fine, or no money goes to the European Commission. I mean, the worst situation as far as the Irish Treasury is concerned is that they get more money from Apple.
Yeah, which is what illegal state aid being recovered effectively means, that they have to go and gather the tax they should have gathered, which would be, well, you could call it a windfall, couldn't you?
From the Irish state point of view, yes, you could call it a windfall. Whether that's actually going to happen, we don't know, because we don't actually know what those transfer prices are, nor does the European Commission. That's what they're looking at. But in the end, yes, the worst case situation as far as Apple is concerned is that they will have to pay some more tax, and the worst case situation as far as the Irish Treasury is concerned is that they will receive some more tax.
These details, which we're probably going to see confirmed today, certainly this week, they are details which, as far as we understand, would already be known to the Irish government in some detail.
Yes. The particular sort of twist here is that Apple apparently went to the Irish government twice over the years and said, look, this is what we're doing in this field. Is that okay by Irish tax law? And we obviously assume that the Treasury then turned around to Apple and said, yes, that's just fine. That's where it becomes, you know, potentially illegal state aid, in the sense that the Commission says that if the Commission finds that the Treasury should have said, no, that's not okay, but they did say, yes, that is okay, then that can be regarded as that illegal state aid. So the Irish government does know all of this, and they're obviously quite clear that it wasn't illegal state aid.
There is a massive, I suppose, international concentration on these issues, not only for Apple, but for Amazon as well, Starbucks also. Why is there such a huge concentration on this? What's the source of it?
The basic error right at the heart of it is that a very large number of people think that companies or corporations should pay more tax. And they're missing the basic economic point that corporations are only a place you collect tax from, rather than being the people who actually bear the economic burden of a tax. When you ask for money from the profits of a corporation, it's either the workers in that company or the shareholders in that company that are really paying the money in that tax. So to ask for a corporation to pay more tax is simply economically illiterate. And yet, the vast majority of us out here actually believe that corporations should pay more tax. And that's where the basic problem comes from. The people who design tax systems realize that corporations aren't the people ultimately paying it, but we, the general public, tend not to.
All right. Tim Worstall of the Adam Smith Institute, thanks for speaking to us this morning.
There are more than 1,500 women homeless in Ireland, but new research suggests state services are failing to address issues directly affecting women. Ahead of a seminar later today, the Simon Community has published a new study which shows that more than 90% of homeless women are the victims of violence. Morning Ireland's Louise Byrne has been meeting one woman with direct experience of sleeping rough on Ireland's streets.
Good evening and welcome. Against the backdrop of a worsening housing crisis,
homeless problem on the streets of our main towns and cities requires
urgent... The government today published a plan to tackle the worsening housing crisis here.
It's an issue that's not going away. Focus Ireland estimates that on any one day, there are up to 5,000 people without a home. For more than a decade on and off, Tracy, who isn't using her real name, was one of those sleeping rough on Dublin streets.
I would have experienced domestic violence right through, like, and you try to shield the kids from it, and then obviously they get to see some sort, because I meant to hold all this together, but yeah, it was like just violence after violence.
Struggling with her domestic situation, Tracy turned to drug abuse.
But yeah, heroin would have been the main thing that I started off. I was never into any sort of drug, even. I tried, once I started on heroin, then I tried every kind of drug gone then, So within 2 years, I found myself homeless with the children. I was just on the loose one day and I seen people I knew and got off the loose, and that was it. I just never went back to the house. Sitting there looking at people going by, going to work or bring their children to school, or look at me, I'm just, everything's passing you by, and it's just hard.
How long, how many nights would you have slept outside?
Going back just even to this last winter, gone straight from October up to April, it would have been out most nights, at least 4 nights out of every week.
Right through the winter?
Yeah.
Tracy's path to homelessness is shared by many other women. Domestic violence, drug use and other traumas form a catalyst which can culminate in homelessness. Once on the streets, women are particularly vulnerable.
It's very hard. You don't trust anyone on them streets. You don't want to trust anyone. It's, you know, you just, yeah, it's very frightening. You're vulnerable. You're like, it makes it kind of hard. Like, even though you're not, you wouldn't be, you don't want to be a hard person. Like, you don't want to be that sort of person. It's like, you have to kind of put up this thing that you can look at yourself. It's very, it's hard. And it's like, degrading. Like, you know, like, you stick out like a sore thumb. You know, like, you still think you're keeping yourself all right, but you're not, like.
Women and homelessness is the subject of new research published by the Simon Community ahead of a seminar on the issue later today. Niamh Randall is the organisation's national spokesperson.
The reason we decided to undertake this particular piece of research looking at women and homelessness is because we're seeing increasing numbers of women attending our services.
Do we have many or any women-only services?
There are some women-only services, and certainly what we would have found in this particular piece is it recommends targeted services, so maybe looking at women-only services, looking at services for young women, and looking at services for women who are pregnant and women and children. But also in terms of looking at existing mainstream homeless services, in terms of how to make them more accessible and to adapt them to ensure they've got the flexibility to respond to these needs as well. Women would often find rough sleeping particularly difficult, and, you know, personal safety issues being of a primary concern. Again, some of the women who participated in the study had experienced maybe violence in one situation or setting and had moved out of that, and unfortunately then experienced it again and again. So what we're seeing is repeating patterns of abuse and repeat patterns of vulnerability.
Tracy is one of the lucky ones. Earlier this year, she entered a detox program with the Simon Community and is experiencing sobriety for the first time in 16 years.
Anyone going through the CFC appreciate it. Like, do you know, when it, for, in some cases, and in my own, it's like, no, this might just sound stupid, but it's like a matter of life and death. Like, it's a lifeline for people.
That's the voice of Tracy ending that report from Louise Byrne.
Now, well, over the next 2 days, 1,300 racehorse buyers will attend the annual Orby sale at Goff's in Kildare. Buyers from Japan, South Africa, Hong Kong, the USA and many other countries will be here to buy Irish yearlings. Henry Beebe is the chief executive of Goff's. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning, Fran. How are you?
Good, good. Busy few days ahead?
Very busy and very exciting. Yeah, it's this. The Orby sale is really the gateway to the world for Irish breeders, and we'll welcome buyers, you said, from all over the world. There'll be probably buyers from 24, 25 different countries over the next 2 days. We'll sell around, I suppose, somewhere between 30 and 35 million euro of the best Irish bloodstock selling to the world. And it's a great showcase for the country. It's a great showcase for something at which we are the best. Ireland's horses are the best. They win all over the world. And we have the next generation here over the next couple of days.
And this sale always attracts some very big names in terms of buyers.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is one of, happily for us, it's one of the world's leading yearling sales. We've sold a classic winner, a European classic winner, in each of the last 9 years. So people know if they want the best, they have to come to Ireland. The best in Ireland are in Goff's. So as the Americans say, do the maths.
You say around 35 million or so in sales. How many yearlings will be for sale?
Well, we've catalogued 450. We'll sell, there's a few withdrawals that won't turn up for various different reasons, and we'll probably sell around 400, 410, something like that, over the next couple of days.
In the last, I suppose, 12 to 16 months, there have been sales which were quite remarkable within the industry. Did it ever really sag massively during the downturn?
Oh, it did. I mean, you know, you have to remember, we are, after all, selling a luxury item. I mean, nobody has to have a racehorse. It's lovely to have one, but you don't have to have one, and they're relatively expensive, you know, in the big scheme of things. So, let put it into context for you. In 2007, in Goff's, we sold around 122 million euro of horses. By 2010, that had dropped to 45 million. happily last year it had risen back up to about 100 million. So we very much rise and fall with the economy. There's no complaint there. We make hay when the sun shines, but we are selling a luxury. And so when the economy dips, we dip with it. When the economy rises, we tend to rise. Although historically you'll find that bloodstock recovers certainly, if not quicker, certainly as quickly as any other industry, which is because, you know, particularly in Ireland, we are a nation of horsemen. We can't do anything else. We don't want to do anything else, and we won't do anything else. And that's why Ireland is so good.
All right. Henry Beebe, Gough's Chief Executive. Thanks for speaking to us this morning.
Sports news now. Pádraic Lodge, good morning to you.
Hi, Gavin. Good morning. Well, Anthony Cunningham has been reappointed as Galway's senior hurling manager for the next 2 years. He has held the role for the past three seasons, but he had to reapply for the job and go through an interview process. But he's been given the thumbs up now to continue in the role. Pat Malone has joined his management team as a selector alongside Damien Curley and Eugene Clunan. And former player Kevin Walsh has been appointed as Galway football manager. He takes over from Alan Mulholland, who stepped down after this year's championship. And his selectors will be Cora Finn's Brian Silk and Sean Conlon from Barna. Now, both Walsh and Cunningham will be subject to annual reviews. Crowds gathered in Cork City last night to welcome home the All-Ireland Ladies Football Champions. Their dramatic one-point win over Dublin saw Cork crowned champions for the fourth year in a row, and with nine titles, they're two behind Kerry in the roll of honour. Gardaí estimate that a crowd of 1,200 was in attendance. The captain of the Kilkenny hurling team, Lester Ryan, has revealed that he learned his winning speech delivered entirely in Irish off by heart, as he doesn't speak the language. Lester Ryan received widespread praise for his speech last Saturday following Kilkenny's win over Tipperary. And on Game On last night, the Clara clubman admitted that a lot of work was required to perfect the words.
I have a teacher friend in Cannon, brother Damien Wren, and he helped me out with the Irish word, so I just learned it. After we played Limerick, I learned it in the first few days after that, and he helped me with it, and I broke it down phonetically. And I mean, I obviously know that the what Irish means and the G and all the rest, and I would have had a great love for the language, but it wasn't my strongest subject in school, and I went through with him in English what I would like to say and what would sound well, and learned it off by heart in the first week after the Limerick match, and then went back to training.
No shame in that.
No, in fairness, we did very well. Nobody would have spotted it listening to the speech. He nailed it.
He'll give lessons maybe to some of us who struggle.
Perhaps. The second round of group games in the Champions League gets underway tonight with 8 games. The fixture list includes Manchester City at home to Roma and Chelsea away to Sporting Lisbon. Diego Costa will start for Chelsea, with manager Jose Mourinho acknowledging that it's a risk because of Costa's fitness. He also wants his top scorer to play against Arsenal on Sunday. Didier Drogba is ruled out with an ankle injury. Stoke City beat Newcastle United 1-0 in the English Premier League last night. Peter Crouch scored the only goal after 15 minutes. The result increases the pressure on the Newcastle manager Alan Pardew. The club is now second last in the table, only off bottom spot on goal difference, and it's the club's worst start to a league campaign in 11 seasons. After the game, Pardew addressed the unrest among supporters.
I think it's important that, you know, I show to the team that I'm here to lead the team, and that's what I do. I've never really been in this situation before. It's a bit unique, but you know, I'm a professional football manager. That's what I do, and that's what I'll continue to do. Today it was tough for us, slight margins in the game, but unfortunately another defeat for us, and we can't keep getting beat, so we're going to have to address that. Leaves us in a position where we are in the bottom three, and we got to fight, and I have to fight, the team has to fight, and that's what we'll continue to do until we can turn it around.
Europe's winning Ryder Cup captain Paul McGinley has ruled himself out of a return to the role in 2016, saying he couldn't see himself again fulfilling an official role with the European team. He was responding to calls to stay on after taking charge of an emphatic win over the United States. He will instead sit on the committee that will pick his successor. Saturday's Pro 12 rugby clash between Leinster and Munster at the Aviva Stadium is heading for a sellout. Over 38,000 tickets have already been sold for the match, which is a 6:30 kickoff. Ulster expect to have Paddy Jackson, Rob Herring and Jared Payne available after injury for their game against Edinburgh. Ian Henderson underwent hip surgery last Thursday and he began his rehab yesterday. His progress will be reviewed in 3 months' time. And former Cheltenham winner Ted Veal justified his position as the even money favourite to win the Grade 3 Kilbegnet Novice Chase at Roscommon. Barry Geraghty's mount won by a length and a quarter from Meath trainer Tony Martin.
Pádraic, thank you for that. 22-8. Let's speak to a publican now who says that staff who'll be serving his customers in his pubs just have to be Irish. Charlie Chalk, good morning.
Good morning.
You're quoted in the Irish Independent. I believe it's essential to have Irish staff behind the bar or on the floor because they have the personality to get on with customers. Are you serious?
Well, I think I've been misquoted a bit. What I meant was at front of house, I like to have Irish people on my premises serving, seating, meeting, and greeting people, because it has been well established by both Falsa and others that when people come to Dublin, they want to visit, or to Ireland, they want to visit the Irish pub. And I do believe, and it's a formula that I've worked on, that what they really mean is they want to meet Irish people, and they want to engage with them, and that's what we work on.
So is it a fact that you only hire Irish people to serve customers?
Oh, not at all. No. That's front of house.
Yes, no, but front of house will serve staff. We'll serve customers. Is it the case that those front of house people who serve customers in your pubs are all Irish?
No. The people they meet when they come into the pub first are Irish, and they meet and see and greet them, and then other nationalities serve them and engage them from there on. But the Cade Mhíle Fáilte, we like to get the Cade Mhíle Fáilte across to the tourists, and to do that, I think we need Irish people.
And you believe people who aren't Irish are incapable of welcoming somebody into a pub?
Well, that's not the point. It's not. They have the Irish accent, and they have the Irish bloss, and they're best, in my opinion, they're best at service. Ireland people have great personalities, and it's what the tourists are looking for, and it's what we work on, and we certainly have lots of other international people serving you and preparing food and everything else, with chefs all over the place are foreign, and it's just that we like to get the bit of loss, the bit of Cade Mhíle Fáilte thing across, and welcome them to our establishments.
You're aware of the legality of not employing people for certain jobs on the basis of their nationality. You are?
I am, of course, and we do imply we have very many non-nationals working for us in the service
foreign
industry.
Nationals.
Well, people other than Irish.
Yes, but you won't employ them front of house to welcome people into your establishments.
Well, we employ Irish people there because we feel they're the best.
How do you think your customers might feel about that?
Well, I think people would be delighted with the reception they get when they come into our premises.
And you don't think that a Polish national, a Latvian, a Spanish person, a French person would be capable of giving the same welcome?
Well, not in the same tongue, in the same language. And they do their job, and they do it very well for me. And I have lots of them employed. It's not that I don't wish to and want to employ foreign people. Of course I don't. Of course I do. I mean, they are wonderful as well, and they do a great job for me. And I have lots of them employed.
All right. Charlie Chalk, thanks for speaking to us this morning. Conor Brophy's here now with business.
Fran, thanks. Well, Sean Quinn is the Chief Executive of Falsa Ireland. Sean, I know you're here with us to talk about a tourism sentiment survey, but you've been listening to Charlie Chalk there saying that to get the Cade Mhíle Fáilte, as he put it, you need Irish staff in those positions. Do you have a response to that?
Well, I suppose not to respond to a specific issue, but our own research, I'd have to say, there's no evidence from consumers that they have an issue as to the nationality of staff, and particularly in Dublin, where they would expect a multicultural workforce. I mean, tourism in most developed economies has a multicultural workforce. And in many cases, they add to what we have already. So it certainly is not coming up as an issue.
You speak to people from across the sector all the time, obviously, and indeed we're going to get to that in one moment in a large piece of research that you've done. Are the views that Charlie Chalk has advanced there, would they be widespread within the industry, do you think?
I don't think so. I can't. What I know is the industry really believe that tourism can contribute more in terms of employment in the country, whether that is Irish employees or international employees, and that's a major part of the thrust of the strategy at the moment, is to increase employment, and I think that's going to be, they're going to address that by hopefully employing more at home and more from abroad.
In terms of the tourism barometer that you've done here, the prospects for growth and employment seem to be quite strong, because 74% of the respondents that you've spoken to for your latest barometer say they're upbeat about their 2014 performance. If you compare that to 14% when the same survey was undertaken in 2008, and tourism is back is the statement you've made alongside that.
Yeah, certainly the signs of recovery that have been sort of evident for a while, they're more widespread across the country, across more sectors. Certainly is a very strong feeling of optimism within the industry. The visitor number figures, you know, for this year are quite strong, but you need to peel away at those figures. Half that growth are people visiting friends and relatives. So that doesn't normally translate into more people in hotel rooms. They're probably staying in with families. So we can't get carried away with ourselves. The numbers are good. We're turning a corner. I think we need to build on this.
Two initiatives we've seen in past years, both of which you would have been involved closely with, The Gathering firstly and the Wild Atlantic Way more recently, they're credited with attracting more visitors. They seem to be spreading the spend out more as well, which is crucial. What's the next trick?
Look, judging by the figures, I think The Gathering probably has a legacy effect, seeing more friends and relatives coming in into this year, and we're trying to continue at a local level. Wild Atlantic Way, yeah, absolutely. But that's a long-term project. That's not a one-hit wonder. We've got many, many more years of development and investment to do in that project. We're looking currently at the South and East and also at Dublin. They're sort of the three kind of main planks to the Irish tourism brand. But I think it's not really about coming up with new gimmicks on an annual basis. It's really doing what we have to do well, becoming more competitive, offering what the consumer wants. And that's what's behind some of the figures. Disposable incomes in our key source markets are improving. Our value for money ratings are up, believe it or not, up across all markets. And there's a pent-up demand and we've got more access. So there's a number of factors coming together at the moment, which is helping the trade.
You mentioned competitiveness there, but at a time when the economy is, touch wood, a little bit more buoyant than it has been for some time, is there wage pressure there from staff?
Well, that's natural. As businesses improve, and this is a labour-intensive industry. You know, we talked earlier on where should they come from, but this is a highly labour-intensive industry. If we have to cater for more visitors, we got to expand the workforce, and that's what's coming through. I mean, since the VAT was cut to 9% in 2011, we probably have an increased employment by 30,000, you know, which is not bad in a single sector.
And those are staff who I presume will perhaps quite rightfully expect to share in any dividend as business improves. So how do you manage that alongside the need to keep prices at a competitive level, which has been credited with increasing visitor numbers over recent years?
Yeah, well, I think it's not a case of just wage increases. I think we've got to become more competitive at how we run our businesses, re-engineer some of the processes. Some of them needn't be as labour intensive as they have been in the past. You know, it's as it would be in any other sector.
Sean Quinn, Chief Executive of Fulch Ireland, thanks very much for coming into us this morning. Briefly, the Irish exploration company Providence Resources has half-year results out this morning, a €3.4 million loss compared to a €1.3 million loss in the same period last year. And in currency news, the euro trading at $1.269 and 78.1 pence sterling.
Connor, thank you for that.
There were 47 people waiting on trolleys or chairs in the emergency department at University Hospital Limerick yesterday morning. They were admitted for care, but were waiting for beds as inpatients at the hospital. Nurses say the scale of the queue represents an emergency. Let's speak to a representative of the INMO now. Mary Fogarty is on the phone. Mary, good morning to you.
Good morning.
How many of your patients are waiting this morning?
Well, this morning at the hospital, there are 38 patients have been placed right throughout the hospital on extra beds and trolleys and in areas of the hospital that are normally used for day activity. And there are a further 23 patients waiting in the emergency department for placement.
Your hospital often has figures as high as this morning. Why did it reach as high as 47 yesterday?
Well, it's been extremely bad all over the summer period at the hospital. We are very concerned. We've raised these issues with management. Ultimately, what we're dealing with here is a mismanaged reconfiguration process over a number of years, where now all acute care is undertaken in the University Hospital in Limerick.
How long have these patients been waiting?
Some of these patients can be waiting up to 48 hours for beds. They're elderly patients. And so the main concern from the patients, the nurses and their relatives is that some of the patients are waiting up to 10 hours before they even see a doctor. And at that point in time, their condition has deteriorated. So there's absolutely no doubt, and it's confirmed from HICWA in the review in June of this year, that these delays and this type of overcrowding is having negative impacts on the outcomes for patients.
Do all those waiting have a bed or a trolley while they're waiting?
No, all of those waiting don't always have a bed or trolley. They can be placed on a chair. But any patient who's required to lie on a trolley in a very overcrowded and unsuit or unfit for purpose emergency department, it's just not acceptable.
In your view, Mary, what's the answer?
Well, we are calling on the Minister for Health now to put in place the funding for an additional 30 beds at the hospital. They can come on stream very quickly. We're also seeking that the hospital is robustly managed in the context of when it gets to a certain level, a peak level, it should never reach 47 patients on trolleys. That is a crisis, and they should be able to implement the major incident plan at the hospital to ensure that's safe for patients and for staff.
Isn't Limerick already way over budget?
Yes, Limerick is €17 million over budget, but I don't think the Minister or the HSE have any option but to put these beds in place as a matter of urgency. From our figures over the last number of years, we've gone from in 2007, in the month of August, to 32 patients in total on trolleys, up to this year, in the month of August, 458 patients. So something has to be done here. It does require investment, it requires resources, and it requires more beds.
Have you made more has Limerick Hospital made more space available in its emergency department? Because often when more space is made available, the numbers simply rise.
They have no space. That is the problem in Limerick, that it is in a very small and unfit for purpose emergency department. So there is no space there. These patients are lying on trolleys in communal areas of the department, open to full view of the public, absolutely no dignity. Their conditions are deteriorating while they're waiting to be seen. It's completely unacceptable and it's not safe. And the Minister for Health has to now come forward with funding as a matter of urgency to put in place a minimum of 30 beds.
Mary Fogarty, thank you. That's Mary Fogarty, Industrial Relations Officer with the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation. 7:47.
Let's find out what the weather holds in store. Vincent O'Shea is at Metairn. Good morning, Vincent.
Hello, Fran, and good morning, everyone from Metairn. Even though it is a bright and a very pleasant start over most of the eastern half of the country, the forenoon will be mostly cloudy with scattered patches of drizzle or very light rain. This will clear, though, to leave a dry afternoon with still a lot of cloud about, but some sunny breaks will develop too, especially later in the afternoon. Highest temperatures today will range from 17 to 20 degrees with just moderate southerly breezes. Tonight will be mild and mostly overcast. Much of the night will be dry, but a short spell of rain will recur later in the night. However, amounts of rain will be very small. Moderate southwest winds tonight, lows temperatures 8 to 11 degrees. Tomorrow Wednesday will be a brighter and fresher day than of late. The day will be dry though, with varying small amounts of cloud and good sunny spells. Top temperatures will range from 14 to 17 degrees with just light southwest winds. And looking further ahead, Thursday will be mostly cloudy with outbreaks of rain, though the rain will be light and patchy and will affect mainly the north and west of the country. Southwest winds will be moderate, highest temperatures in the high teens. Friday will be a dry day in most places with some sunny breaks again, but it will turn noticeably cooler and more unsettled for Saturday and the weekend, with rain or showers occurring widely. The rain will be most persistent during Sunday, accompanied by fresh west winds. Finally, I'll leave you with a recap on today. It'll be cloudy for a time with some patchy rain, but most of the day will be dry and mild. That's the forecast. Good morning.